From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Mina Kim. The recent church shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, has much of the country thinking about hate, specifically the people and groups that inspire acts of violence. White supremacist and other radical groups may seem like a problem in the Midwest or the South, certainly not in California. But to varying degrees, the entire nation is a breeding ground for the kind of racism and intolerance that got 9 people killed. In this hour, we'll explore a world you will hopefully never encounter and consider what it might take to prevent more tragedies like the Charleston massacre. Homegrown hate. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Mina Kim. This is an excerpt from the online manifesto of Dylan Roof, the young white man accused of killing 9 people in a historic black church in Charleston, South Carolina. Again, I am reading his words. Quote, "Negroes have lower IQs, lower impulse control, and higher testosterone levels in general. These 3 things alone are a recipe for violent behavior. If a scientist publishes a paper on the differences between the races in Western Europe or Americans, he can expect to lose his job. There are personality traits within human families and within different breeds of cats or dogs, so why not within the races?" Unquote. With rhetoric like this, it's easy to see why Roof allegedly wanted to spark a race war with his rampage. But where did he get these ideas? Was it just a function of living in South Carolina, the first state to secede during the Civil War? Did he have to search for a group of people in his town who would encourage these lies in his mind? Or was he truly a lone wolf, acting alone with only a weak link to others like him? The answer could be the key to stopping more attacks and saving more lives. In this hour of Forum, we'll discuss the rise of homegrown hate groups and what we can do about them. Joining us by phone is Brian Levin. He is the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State San Bernardino. Brian, welcome to Forum.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us by phone is Nancy McLean. She teaches history and public policy at Duke University, and she is the author of Behind the Mask of Chivalry, The Making of the Second Ku Klux Klan. Nancy, glad to have you with us.
Glad to be with you.
Also calling in from Duke University is David Shanzer. He is the director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security, part of Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy. David, welcome.
Thank you.
I want to start by kind of going around the table, as it were, our virtual table, and ask you all the tough question. Why did this happen? How did we get to a point in this country where a young man would feel empowered to walk into a church, pretend to be worshiping for an hour, although maybe he did worship, we don't know, and then say what he said and do what he did? Nancy McLean, let me start with you. Why did this happen?
Well, I think, of course, we have to separate out the situation of an individual who is pathetic and disturbed from a larger context that shaped the nature of his view of the world. And so while, of course, I think anyone who has seen and read about this horrible tragedy is appalled by it and by the pictures of him posing with the Confederate flag and posing at the Confederate Museum and burning the American flag, you know, in preparation for killing all of these wonderful people who were so beloved to their family members. I think we're all reeling from that. But I think there's been a kind of a rush to individualize this and to make it sound like in dealing with this young man and calling for the death penalty, as the governor of South Carolina has, that somehow we're going to exorcise the demons that we now see are loose in our public life. And I guess I have to say as a historian that I think that this is a moment, what we in schools call a teachable moment, when we have a lot to learn from what happened here. And I think the toxins that were feeding this young man, we can trace back a half a century. Back in 1960, President Kennedy talked about that Confederate uniform that Barry Goldwater has been wearing as he toured the South for the Senate committee trying to recruit for the Republican Party. I don't want to take up too much time in the beginning here, but there's a long history that flows from there and a lot of support for Confederate ideas as a deliberate political strategy. And that's what I think we need to get the bottom of and really get more exploration of in the months ahead to understand what happened here and to prevent it from happening again.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get into that history with you for sure. Let me continue around the table with David Shanzer. Why did this happen?
Well, your question suggested that we've kind of somehow built up to this moment and, you know, this happened. Whereas, you know, I think a better way to think about it is, you know, there have always been these individuals on the margins of society, and different ones of them for different reasons, and many seeped in history, as Nancy's laid out, latch on to these ideas. And also, not only, you know, get committed to the ideas, but decide in their mind that they must take violent action to try to advance those ideas. And, you know, it's happened throughout our country. It's happened in European societies. And, you know, no matter how good we are at trying to educate and prevent these things, you know, we're always going to have this problem. There are always going to be marginal people on the margins who decide to take violence to perpetuate what are, you know, always these fringe, non-mainstream ideologies.
And Brian Levin, why did this happen?
Well, I think it happened because of a combination of different factors. First, it shows the reach of these horrendous stereotypes that still plague our country that came from the slavery era. Judge Leon Higginbotham wrote about these precepts related to African Americans, and both the trans-historic reach of these, as well as how they can ensnare someone who is troubled and angry through hate groups that exist today, like the Council of Conservative Citizens.
You know, let's get into that historic, trans-historic reach, as you put it, with a little more. Nancy McLean, what can you tell us about that historic reach? Your research involves the Ku Klux Klan and groups like the Council of Conservative Citizens. First of all, let's clarify. I think many people have heard of the KKK, but who was the Council of Conservative Citizens? What is that?
The Council of Conservative Citizens grew out of the white citizens' councils that were formed after the Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus Board of Education that public schools should not be segregated by race, that
this
that
was
a violation. Yes, I'm sorry. That was 1954, yes. And they were launched in Mississippi and quickly spread across the Deep South as a kind of respectable but virulently racist force to oppose the civil rights movement and oppose civil rights reform. And they actually did a very effective job at limiting civil rights, at limiting school desegregation, at injecting really, really toxic hatred into the public discussion, and also rationalizing their case in terms of a particular view of the Constitution that actually did come out of the Confederacy. And so, you know, we can trace back this pro-Confederate moment to then, and it was actually at this point that many Southern states began to put up Confederate flags over their state houses. So this is not about heritage from the 19th century. This is actually about a reaction to what was happening in the mid-20th century with the Civil Rights Movement. And then in later years, when the White Citizens Council was not as popular and its views became increasingly problematic, it changed its name in 1985 to the Conservative Citizens Council. But it continued to have the same views. It, you know, has set up on its website until recently that it opposes all efforts to mix the races. It opposes efforts to bring African Americans and immigrants into the mainstream of American democracy, you know, and much more, the kind of thing that you read out from the Shooter's Manifesto.
And just to be clear, I want to make sure that this is – we're looking at this causatively and not just as a correlation. What you're saying is that this political movement that emerged after Brown v. Board in 1954 was not just kind of tangentially, oh, the KKK, we kind of identify with them. There is a historical through line from one to the other.
Oh, no. No, you had asked me specifically about the Citizens Council. I mean, you know, all of these movements have their, you know, somewhat different dynamics and origins and so forth. My first book was about the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s when it was the largest mass movement of the right in American history and was a quite national movement with as many as 5 million members, elected officials in many states, et cetera. It had different dynamics from the white citizens' councils in many ways. I mean, it made much more, for example, of anti-Catholicism, anti-Semitism. It was very interested in prohibition of enforcement. So it had its own program that came from its own period in time. I think where I see the kinship with the White Citizens Councils is that both of these organizations are founded in a notion of American government that's very proprietary, that says only white people, or in the Klan's case, only white Protestants, have a right to participate in our democracy. And I think as we talk about neo-Confederacy, so that we don't treat it as some kind of exotic thing far from the mainstream, we have to understand that at its root, this is a very anti-democratic impulse. And African Americans have been historically, and as we've seen so tragically recently, are the primary victims.
Yeah.
But this is about a wider effort to restrict democracy in the ugliest possible way. So I think, you know, I do not think that people in the Conservative Citizens Council, I don't think very many people on the planet would condone what this young man did.
Right.
But at the same time, I do believe that they created the climate in which he could find ideas that he could imagine in his twisted way would make him a hero and, like the Ku Klux Klan, present himself as the direct action version of these ideas that are very much mainstream.
Right.
And I guess I'd say that, too, that the thing that really stood out to me from my study of the Klan in the 1920s and that stands out today is it gets very hard to draw a bright line between the mainstream views that enable these movements and the extreme expressions that we see, whether with Ku Klux Klan vigilantism or with this young man. These ideas are very widespread, and it's not just the Conservative Citizens Council. I'm very sorry to say it's also the Republican Party's strategy in the South since the 1960s, and I'd be happy to say more about that specifically if you would like at some point.
Yeah, I think we do need to address that, because I know that's part of the political conversation today about the historical ties between the GOP and conservatism, which used to be the ties between the Democratic Party and conservatism. But we'll get into that a little further in the hour, I hope. We are discussing hate groups in America with Nancy McLean of Duke University, Duke's David Shanzer, and Brian Levin of Cal State San Bernardino. We welcome your questions and your thoughts and your reactions as the nation is pondering what we do about this kind of immense racial violence, this kind of hateful, murderous rhetoric, and as the president prepares to eulogize the reverend who was killed, Clementa Pinckney, who was killed at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston. What are your thoughts and your questions about what to do about this kind of hate in our borders? Give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also post your comments online. Go to kqed.org/forum. And I should make it clear, since this is an hour about some very controversial stuff, we welcome all points of view on this matter. No matter what side of the issue you're on, whether you're totally confused about the issue, you are welcome to be part of this conversation. So please call in 866-733-6786. Brian Levin from Cal State San Bernardino, what about the picture in California? I think a lot of people figure that this kind of thing is really a Midwestern thing or a Southern thing. I don't think some people kind of batted an eye when they heard this happened and this guy was wearing a Rhodesian flag and all that stuff, like, oh yeah, the South. But California is not immune to any of this, are we?
No, we have about 1,000 reported hate crimes each year. And again, the reported hate crimes appear far lower than what appears to be out there from the victimization surveys, where there's a huge gap. FBI counts around 5,000 to 6,000 reported hate crimes, whereas the Bureau of Justice Statistics last counted about 294,000. So big range. What I would say is that hate groups today, and I think in California it's true as well, have become more diffuse, more localized. Some of the bigger national groups have really taken a hit. National Socialist Movement lost two of its West Coast leaders to violent deaths. So So that's something. But I do think that California does have an interesting mix of hate groups. And interestingly enough, a diverse group which covers different ethnicities and races too. But we don't have the kind of over the top, organized, maybe statewide presence that we had in years prior from either the National Socialist Movement, Aryan Nations, or White Aryan Resistance. So it tends to be much, much more localized. And with regard to far right, mostly we're talking about militias and maybe skinhead groups, as well as other entities that are anti-immigrant and Holocaust denial.
David Chanzer from Duke, I wonder how you think that maybe the trajectory of these homegrown hate groups and the trajectory of terrorist organizations might be similar. I mean, it seems like just the advent of the internet alone has changed the way that these ideologies spread in local communities across the country and around the world.
Well, you raise an interesting question because you made a distinction between, you know, terrorist groups and hate groups, and you know, that's been part of the national discussion. To me, what I call terrorism is violence taken in furtherance of a political objective by using, you know, fear against civilian populations. And these, so I would call them all extremist groups or terrorist groups, because that is what they are doing, those that at least advocate openly the use of violence to bring about their objectives. So, you know, in terms of the trends, you know, both of them, in terms of the actual violence, both of them comprise of a very small percentage of the overall violence that we see in society. 215,000 murders, homicides in the United States since 9/11, and depending on who's doing the counting, you know, hundreds of deaths due to extremist organizations in the United States. So a very, very small fraction. Nonetheless, you know, as the study that I'm sure we're going to get to that we've been doing does show that there have been more deaths in the United States due to, you know, anti-government types of groups, anti-government extremism, as opposed to groups or individuals who have been inspired by Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
We're going to continue with this conversation in a moment, and we are going to be speaking later on in the hour with the head of the Southern Poverty Law Center about its tracking of these kinds of groups and their activities in the U.S. But I think first let's try to get in a few calls before we hit the bottom of the hour, 866-733-6786, beginning with David in Santa Rosa. David, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have a question generally about why does this seem to be perpetuated particularly by men, young men? We don't see women going into theaters and killing people, into churches and killing people. So I guess that's my question, is something about gender of this. And are there women involved in these groups?
David, that's a good question. David Chanzer, can I put that to you first?
Well, I think your other guest could talk about the more domestic racist groups and why men are involved. But in the on the side of like the Al-Qaeda, ISIS, overwhelmingly the perpetrators, but not exclusively, that have happened in the United States have are men. Men are more attracted to the uses of violence. I mean, we see that in regular run-of-the-mill homicides as well. So you'd have to have a psychologist on to try to explain why it is that men are more violent than women are. But it's true across different kinds of activities.
Let me put that question to Nancy McLean. Can you chime in on that?
Yes, I can, because part of what I was doing in my study of the Ku Klux Klan was looking at men as people of gender, if you will, because the Klan very much had a strong gender ideology. You know, their actual name was the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. They appealed to these historic traditions of chivalry. They built on the model of male fraternal orders, and they styled themselves the protectors of white women, white Protestant women. So so there's a deep current of men styling themselves as heroes coming to the defense of victimized women. And we saw that in the manifesto of the Charleston shooter when he said that African Americans are raping our women and taking over our country. This is the historic posture of groups like this to present themselves and their people as the victims of others, which in turn, you know, enables or justifies aggressive attack as self-defense, but there's also this particular element that lets them feel like they are heroes for looking out for women. And the Ku Klux, I mean, it's not to say that women are immune to this stuff. The women, there was a strong women of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s too that organized as a kind of auxiliary to the men's order. But what they did was much more the mainstream stuff of spreading rumors about Catholics and Jews, of organizing boycotts, of, you know, organizing various kinds of social events to sustain the movement and that kind of thing. But the men were really styled as the people who would engage in the vigilante activity.
Let's continue on the phones now with Andy in Oakland. Andy, good morning.
Hey, good morning, everybody. I'd like to ask a question of the panel, and anybody can participate. I'd like to get your sense on the impact that the internet has had, and let's just say, you know, using the last 20 or maybe even 30 years as the context, of the ability of hate groups to spread what they're saying and their messages to children. I'd also like to see if you could tie that into to its impact on families to have intelligent and rational conversations about what children can see about messages from hate groups on the internet. And I'm happy to take my questions and answers offline. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing it, Andy. Brian Levin, would you take that on?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the internet has been critical, and what I think is really important is that it transcends ideology. I've spoken with David. He has a wonderful report out. He'll talk about that later. But one of the things we've seen is the role of the internet to ensnare young people and young adults into hateful ideologies. You know, Stormfront was the first hate site on the web back in February 95, and they actually had a Stormfront for Kids, which had little blocks and colors on it. There were also more nefarious things where, like, someone had a MartinLutherKing.com website, and it was actually a racist website, but it kind of ensnared you in. Initially, it looked like just an educational one, but then when you go into it, it had hateful and defamatory things about Dr. King on there. So that's the landscape, and of course, the internet is so broad and diffuse now that it's all over. So one of the problems that we have is beyond certain places where we know are legitimate sources, young people will have hits come up from places that are not legitimate.
And right.
One of the things that we know with regard to young people, forgetting about just the hate mongers, is that most hate offenders in the United States are thrill offenders who are out for excitement and peer validation, and they're often intoxicated.
Hey, Brian, I'm sorry. I hate to cut you short. That's a good point to pause on. We're coming up on a break right now. But we're going to continue our conversation when we come back at the bottom of the hour on hate groups in America with Nancy McLean of Duke University, Duke's David Shanzer, and Brian Levin of Cal State San Bernardino. I'm Joshua Johnson. Good to be with you today. Please do stay with us. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Mina Kim. We're discussing hate groups in America with Nancy McLean of Duke University, Duke's David Shanzer, and Brian Levin of Cal State San Bernardino. We'd love to add your voice to the conversation. Call us, 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. Brian Levin, you were making a point before the break, and I wanted to give you a chance to finish what you were saying. Go ahead.
It was merely this. We tend to concentrate on these horrendous type of killings, and I think that's important. But one of the things I think we have to look at are the micro offenses that take place and the interpersonal indignities that take place routinely in our society, and how that's promoted by the diffusion of negative stereotypes throughout our culture, and that's a reach that the internet has as well. And with respect to just tying it into the offenders really quickly, most hate offenders are not hardcore hate mongers. They're out for excitement and peer validation, and those stereotypes will oftentimes turn that switch up to people who have otherwise shallow prejudices. So that was a point that I wanted to make beyond the big hate group and homicide points.
Oh, and Brian, one more thing. I almost forgot to ask. Are there one or two groups of particular concern in California that are classified as hate groups? I mean, is it biker gangs or black nationalists or maybe something that appears more benign? What are the primary groups of concern in our state?
Well, I think we have like the Institute for Historical Review, which is a Holocaust denial outfit. We also have some anti-Muslim groups here, like Jihad Watch. We even have a League of the South out here. I mean, we have quite a few, as well as, you know, Aryan and neo-Nazi type groups like the National Socialist Movement. We also have some hate groups on the other side, like Asa Bikwin, which wants to put forth a fundamentalist religious rule in California, which would be anti-Semitic, anti-Christian, and anti-gay.
Gotcha. That's Brian Levin of Cal State San Bernardino. Brian, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's add another voice to our conversation. Joining us now on the line is Richard Cohen, the president of the Southern Poverty Law Center. The group focuses on tracking hate groups nationwide and fighting them through litigation, education, and advocacy. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
What do you see as the state of hate groups in this country right now?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. The number of hate groups in our country right now is probably 30% higher than it was 15 years ago. And that's because of the, you know, maybe the reaction to the changing demographics of our nation. You know, for many people, you know, President Obama ran on a platform of change, and for many people, he represents the kind of change that people are scared of. But the interesting thing also is that the number of hate groups has actually dipped somewhat in the last few years. And the reason we think that that's the case is many people are leaving the big groups and retreating to the anonymity of the net. We haven't seen a diminution in racist violence, and we've actually seen an uptick in the number of people who, for example, register in order to post hateful rhetoric on a website like Stormfront. It's increased by about 50% over the past 3 years, post 5 years, excuse me. You know, now it totals about 300,000. So, you know, we've seen a morphing of hate group activity in our country in the last few years.
So let me make sure I fully understand you. Activity is up, but the number of groups is down? Is that right?
I think that's right.
So people are becoming more, so the whole lone wolf thing, I hate using that expression, but it seems to be the best one that we have to describe this, seems to be the way that things are going?
I think that that's right. Most hate violence isn't committed by members of hate groups. It's often committed by people who are inspired by their rhetoric. But most of the hate violence is committed by persons who are not formally affiliated with any group. The Charleston shooter is a prime example. He trolled the net. He not only put out a manifesto, he was active on a website called The Daily Stormer. But he wasn't formally associated or affiliated with any of these groups. So he would be an example of just what you're talking about, a lone wolf.
How has the proliferation of technology affected what the Southern Poverty Law Center does? Has it made it harder because the activity is more diffuse, or has it made it easier because there are all these digital breadcrumbs to follow, or maybe a little bit of both?
I think a little bit of both. It's made it more complicated. We continue to get all of the hate group literature in the country. We continue to monitor events such as, you know, public rallies and whatnot. We continue to hear from people, concerned citizens all over the country about hate group activity in the real world. And also we spend a lot of time and effort and money monitoring, you know, hate on the net. Some of it is very difficult to see, right? There's a lot of private chat rooms on the net. There's this whole thing called the dark web that is, you know, not accessible to the average user of Google. And so, you know, through a variety of investigative techniques, you know, we try to keep tabs on both the, you know, the real world of hate and the cyber world of hate.
Let's continue on the phones now with Damien in Santa Rosa. Damien, good morning.
Good morning.
What's on your mind, Damien?
Basically, I think my name is Damien Square. I'm a co-president of the Black Student Union here at the Santa Rosa Junior College here locally. And I think I like the fact that you guys are having this discussion. Definitely applaud that. But I think we're kind of missing the point slightly by focusing on the idea of the hate groups, which are very real. But the hate groups are essentially just embodying a particular ideology. And that ideology is racism, white supremacy. That particular ideology is intrinsically intertwined into the very fabric of the Constitution, of the founding documents of this particular country. So when we talk about racism, white supremacy, and how intertwined it is into the founding documents of this country, when we talk about how the founding fathers said that all men are created equal, we now know they weren't talking about all men. They were talking about all rich, white, property-owning men. So we have to start having the real discussion, which is the discussion and the issue that is facing the colored people of this country, and not only of this country, of the planet, which is white supremacy. And this country, white supremacy is essentially controlling the institutions, the various institutions that govern our lives. Mm-hmm. Political institution, economic institution, educational institution. When you look at the demographic and the makeup of the United States, it's not fairly balanced.
Right.
The civil rights movement was able to somewhat successfully attack and address the institutionalized form of racism, white supremacy, but what they could not erode or what they could not erase, which is the belief and the idea of racism, white supremacy, which is still so intrinsically embedded into the very foundation of this country that it's going to be a very, very, very hard to get it out.
Hey, Damien, I hate to cut you short. We got to keep going on other calls, but since I have you on the line, and since you said you're with the Black Students Organization at Santa Rosa Junior College, I just kind of wonder how you read the climate on campus these days or up in Santa Rosa for African Americans. We don't hear much about the Black community up there. Do you see these problems in the North Bay, or is it kind of in the North Bay the way it is in the rest of the Bay Area?
In North Bay, it is just the way it is in the other areas. It's just not as advertised. You don't just see it as much. But we do a lot of things up here. I mean, I'm pretty sure you guys heard about Andy Lopez.
Oh, yes.
A couple of years back that was, you know, pretty much assassinated by a police officer who is now back on duty patrolling the same streets. So we have those same issues, and we're having those same fights and those same struggles and those same situations that are happening to us.
Right.
This issue of white supremacy is embedded into this culture. And until we can, it's a sickness. It's a psychological sickness that we as a country have not been able to confront honestly and openly the issue of racism, white supremacy.
And Damien, I'm sorry to cut you short. We're going to have to keep going. I really appreciate you calling. Thank you very much. And for those of you who had not followed KQED's coverage of the Andy Lopez shooting, Andy Lopez was a teenager in Santa Rosa who was shot by a Sonoma County Sheriff's deputy who the deputy says he believed he was threatened by what appeared to be a weapon that Andy Lopez was holding. Andy Lopez turned out not to have been carrying an actual firearm. Let's continue on the phones now with Fred in Oakland. Fred, good morning.
Hi. Early on, the woman started to say something about the Republicans. Do you remember that?
Yeah, we can revisit that. Nancy McClain, Fred, was there something in particular that you wanted Nancy McClain to follow up on?
Everything and anything she wants to say.
Okay. All right.
And I'll be glad to hang up.
Okay. Well, Fred, I appreciate you bringing us back to that. Nancy McClain, we were going to get a little bit more into some of the ties between legacy hate organizations and conservative politics today. Can you keep drawing that line for us, please?
Absolutely. And I also want to speak to Damien's point because I think it's really important to keep in play. You know, the Constitution, there is a book called The Slaveholder's Constitution by a very important legal scholar. And it points to the fact that mentions of slavery are embedded throughout the Constitution, the most obvious being the representation of the South with the three-fifths clause, where population, i.e. enslaved African Americans, counted for three-fifths of a person for purposes purposes of taxation and representation. And it's that kind of embedding of slavery into the Constitution that gives these white supremacist groups a continuing sense of legitimacy. You know, when they talk about the Constitution as originally conceived, they're gesturing to some of that. So I think his point about the long history is really important. And I also think in terms of history, I will say that I'm really afraid that as the funerals go on for these people whose lives were so tragically snuffed out, we're going to forget this story and the media is going to move on. And I'm just going to issue a plea to any journalists who are out there that as we approach now the 150th anniversary of Reconstruction and we have a presidential election coming, that we start asking candidates what they think about America's greatest democratic experiment after the Civil War, when freed people were enfranchised and began to bring us our first public schools in the South, our first public hospitals, all of these things. I think that would flush out a lot of this pro-Confederate thinking that created the climate in which this young man did this heinous act. Now, to speak particularly to the question of how the Republican Party has used Confederate thought and, right, and these connections in the South to gain votes, it's sadly a very, very long story with a lot of episodes. But I could tell you that as recently as 2010, Haley Barbour, who's a former Republican national chairman, defended the Conservative Citizens Council and said that its critics were exaggerating racism and that as far as he knew, it was an organization of town leaders. And that's interesting because nearly 20 years ago, Trent Lott, who was then Senate Majority Leader and the third most powerful person in the Republican Party, had given a keynote address to the Conservative Citizens Council that said that they stood for, and I quote, the right principles and the right philosophy. The right principles and the right philosophy. I would love to see journalists begin to dig into that thread. What did they mean in saying the right principles, the right philosophy? After Trent Lott was severely chastised for that appearance, the party's national chairman urged all Republicans to quit the organization, calling it racist in 1999. But here we are again, you know, in 2014 with three candidates for the presidency of the United States taking money from the Conservative Citizens Council and one undeclared candidate, Scott Walker of Wisconsin, getting money from this Earl Holt III when he began his attack on public sector unions in 2011. So I would just—
But didn't those candidates say they were going to give that money back, those three candidates?
Well, now they did. But I mean, for heaven's sake, you know, the Conservative Citizens Council has been exposed for decades for having the views that it has. It's very clear about what it stands for. And I think, you know, one thing we might do is, for example, ask Scott Walker, you know, please release the letter that Earl Holt III sent you with that contribution, with the contributions he started giving in 2011. Please release all that correspondence under Freedom of Information Act legislation so that we can understand why it is a Wisconsin politician, you know, so far away from the old Confederacy, is getting support from an individual and an organization like that. I just think there's so many questions that this tragedy opens up, and I really hope that we will not stop pursuing them.
Yeah. Hey, Nancy, I hate to cut you short. I do want to get back to some of our calls and emails and comments. And I, as you mentioned it, you know, the funeral service is underway for the slain pastor right now. The president has yet to speak on that. That will be covered later on during the day on NPR's Here and Now. I should also mention we had part of the conversation involved the dark net, this other part of the internet that is not really what you would find in your web browser on Facebook. Fresh Air did an hour about the dark net recently. You can find the audio on NPR's technology blog, All Tech Considered. If you search Fresh Air Dark Web, it should be the first hit that comes up. But that was an interview from just a few weeks ago. It's also going to be a topic today on Science Friday, which airs next here on KQED Public Radio. David Schanzer, I want to get back to you in regards to some of what's going on around the world today. You know, it was bad enough that we had to hear the story about this service in Charleston, this immense memorial that the president is about to speak at to basically lay one of his friends to rest. But then we heard about this attack at a beach resort in Tunisia where nearly 30 people are reported killed, and that may have terrorist ties. We also heard this morning about an attack on an American gas facility in the south of France, in southeastern France near Lyon, where one of the workers at the facility was found decapitated his severed head was found near the entrance of this facility, all at the same time as we're talking about what Dylann Roof did. Should we draw tight connections to any of this? Is this just kind of the way things happen to happen and we happen to know more about it because of technology? Or is this one network of hate that we need to deal with?
Well, I don't see connections between the hate groups and the white Confederate movement and what's happening abroad with respect to ISIS and Al Qaeda. But what those three incidents demonstrate to me is basically we are suffering, the world is suffering very deeply from the continued after effects of the Arab uprisings stemming back from 2011, and we have really almost three different civil wars going on, and they were represented in many ways by these attacks. You have a Sunni Shia civil war, regional civil war, and that's reflected in the Kuwait attack on a Shia mosque. You have insurgents attacking established Sunni government, so inter-Sunni civil war going on, and so you see these insurgents attacking Tunisia and trying to essentially gut its economy by decimating the tourist industry. First, there was a month or so ago an attack on a famous art museum, and now a tourist beach that was populated mainly by foreigners. And, of course, you have this ISIS movement, which has spread and has affiliates and individuals inspired by ISIS that is operative in Europe and to a much lesser extent, but still problematic here in the United States, where we're seeing a real spike in the last month of arrests of individuals who have some inclination to engage in violence based on this ISIS ideology. So it is, it's a disturbing time. There's no other way to describe it.
Let's continue on the phones now. 866-733-6786. Ellie in Richmond. Ellie, good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to shift a little bit because it seems like most of the speakers, the Southern Poverty Law Center and some of the others, have been focusing on what you might call right-wing affiliated hate groups. And I think we need to broaden it and also talk about left-wing affiliated hate groups in the United States, whether you talk about it in groups who affiliate with neo-Black Panthers, BDS movement, or other groups that, and it seems like it's hard for those on the left to really self-examine and look at the hate groups that they overlook. And those are quite significant in the United States and I think worldwide. So I'd like to listen to some discussion of that if your guests are willing to self-examine in that way and talk about that.
Sure. Ellie, I think that's a very good question. Richard Cohen, let me put that to you first. What does the SPLC see coast to coast in terms of groups that may have what you might call more of a left-leaning political bent?
Well, I'm not sure I would call those groups left-leaning, but let me say this to the person who called. Thank you for your question. And the truth of the matter is that we do call hate groups, we do call Black separatist groups hate groups. We list numerous groups such as those in California. So the perception that we don't is incorrect. We've long said that if we're in the business of exposing white hate groups, we can't be in the business of explaining away the Black ones. Now, I don't think they're the opposite sides of the same coin, because as repugnant as perhaps the Nation of Islam's ideology may be, it does not have the history of violence of something like the KKK. But it's just a general misperception of at least about our work that we aren't that we don't look at kind of both phenomena. So I just wanted to make that clear. Is it possible for me to make one other point in
Please
response?
Do.
Yeah, in response to your last guest, not your last caller. I mean, I certainly don't see a connection between white nationalism and ISIS. He's certainly right there. But One thing I would add is that the white nationalist movement, of which the Charleston shooter was a part, is an international phenomenon. It's not simply, you know, it may be homegrown to some degree, but, you know, they're international ties. Right now, three of my colleagues are in Budapest at an international conference about white nationalism. You know, we see problems in Europe in the backlash to, you know, increasing immigration. We see that with the Golden Dawn Party, for example, in Greece. We see it with the Jobbik Party in Hungary. These are neo-fascist parties. And, you know, the white persons involved in white supremacy in this country, including the Charleston shooter, see themselves as part of an international movement.
Weren't there also a number of clashes in France and Germany over the last year or so that got completely out of hand?
Absolutely. A tremendous rise in anti-Semitism, you know, in these countries. We've tracked documented 30 cases of people coming, nationals coming from Europe to our country and nationalists from our country going there. So, again, I just think it would be a misconception, and I'm not saying, of course, your guests had that misconception, but it would be a mistake not to recognize the international character of the hate movement.
Let's continue on the phones now with Michael in Berkeley. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question concerning the individual who shot the people in Charleston as a terrorist, particularly by the federal government, because Reverend Pinckley was also a sitting senator, and he was working on legislation that this guy was probably offended by. The other point I'd like to make is there was this survivalist in Pennsylvania who shot that state policeman, I believe, and they didn't call him a domestic terrorist either. So it seems like the government has some reluctance to call white individuals who commit these acts terrorists, and I'm concerned about that.
Michael, that's an interesting point. Nancy McLean, why don't you chime in on that?
Yeah, I think it is really important that we do start to use the word terrorist for these killings because, as Richard pointed out, these acts are terrorism. They're designed to intimidate whole groups of people, so they very much fall under that rubric. And I appreciate the caller raising the issue of the people who were targeted in Charleston too. I heard an amazingly moving sermon from a North Carolina Reverend Barr. I was listening to it on the internet last night about his friend, the Reverend Pinckney, who had been shot, and about what his church stood for. And his church was really in the forefront of organizing for social justice in South Carolina, organizing against the flying of the Confederate flag for a long time. They were trying to win Medicaid expansion for people who aren't covered by insurance in their state. They were fighting the voter suppression efforts that have come out of the state legislature. So they were very much involved in pushing back against the kinds of policies that these folks who fly the Confederate flag, who have pushed Confederate History Month through six state legislatures now, six Republican-controlled state legislatures in the South now mark Confederate History Month, a deliberate slap in the face to Black History Month. You know, there was a Charleston secession ball in 2010 to mark the Fort Sumter anniversary. So there are many, many ways in which state public policy has been pushed that pushes this Confederate ideology out into the mainstream. And there's just no other way we can understand this Confederate ideology except as diminishing the humanity of African-American citizens and discrediting their equal right to participate in the conduct of our democracy. That's what the Confederacy was all about.
You know, we're getting to the end of the hour.
I know our show is limited.
I hate to cut you short, Nancy. We're almost at the end of the hour. I think all of this is a great conversation, and we're going to keep it going online. I did want to respond directly to Ellie's point about calling this terrorism. I'm looking at the FBI's definition of what domestic terrorism is, and it has three characteristics. It involves acts that are dangerous to human life that violate the law. It appears intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, to influence policy, or to affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. And it occurs primarily within the territorial jurisdiction of the U.S. And by many metrics, that would qualify as domestic terrorism, but we'll see how the federal government chooses to prosecute it. Let's go back to the phones as because we're running out of time at coming up on the top of the hour. Let's hear from Diane in San Francisco. Diane, good morning.
Okay, one of the things I'd like to say is that times like this in this country, we focus on these hate groups as if that's an aberration in this country. No, all white people in this country benefit from white supremacy. And it's very easy for them to say, it's not me, I'm not racist, I wouldn't, but they benefit. They allow their stormtroopers to do the dirty work for them, and then they sit back and benefit financially, politically, socially, from what these groups do. And they don't want to say, and the woman that said it's an international issue, she's right. Historically, Europe marched out of Europe with guns, which nobody else in the world had, and took over the world and enslaved people all over the world for their own economic benefit.
You know what, Diane, you make a good point, and I hate to cut you short, but I want to put that point to Richard Cohen very, very briefly for whites who look at these issues and feel some twinge of guilt in terms of the legacy that racism and racial supremacy and hatred have inured today. What would you say to them, briefly?
Briefly, I would say that racism is part of the original sin of this country. It's the big bang in our universe that reverberates in our ears continuously. I do think that we've made enormous racial progress in this country over the years. I live in Alabama. We have hundreds of black elected officials, and you know, interracial relationships are certainly rare and are not rare and don't draw stares in big cities.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, there are racist. This racism embedded in so many of our institutions.
And we'll have to continue the conversation on this another hour. I hate having to cut you off. Richard Cohen of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Nancy McLean of Duke University, also Duke University's David Shanzer, thank you all very much for being with us this hour. And also earlier, Brian Levin of Cal State San Bernardino. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Laubert, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. We get online support from David Marks and Don Clyde. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News. Thank you for listening. Keep the conversation going online and have a great weekend. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.